Wow. Always got to move that. Hi, everybody. My name's Stanley Beach, and I'm an alcoholic. And I'm very happy to be here. Before I get started, I want to mention that the young lady who read the 12 steps is my daughter, Barbie, who's down here from Connecticut. And I spoke at a conference in New Haven a couple weeks ago, and she was the chairman of the conference and ran the whole show, and it really made me feel good to see. I have another daughter in AA, and it's just wonderful what happens when one of your children join AA. You start speaking a new language, you have a new connection, and it really is quite amazing how you just get closer, and I'm very grateful for that. And Carol and I are really grateful to be invited here, and we've had a delightful time meeting new friends, and God, this panel of speakers, I've just been with them. Most of them I've known for 30 years, somewhere in that range. And we cross paths from time to time, and I hear about them, and we swap stories, and when we have issues, sometimes we call each other. I just know that if I ran it by Bob Darrell, I'd get a great response, or Tom, or anybody. It's wonderful to have that reservoir of spiritual perception that you can draw on. If you could get your ego out of the way, to ask for help. So I just want you to know that you never stop doing that. And I'll give you a good example. When I was new, well, everything frightened me when I was newly sober. I was frightened, just frightened. That's why I drank. But I just seemed to be more nervous than some. I had to get a half a cup of coffee because a full one, I couldn't make it back to the chair. And I jiggled everything sitting on the chair, the St. Vitus dance. I had St. Everything dance, and it just never could sit still. And one of the things that terrified me the most was the thought of dying. I don't know if it bothers any of you. But just to hear the word, the Grateful Dead, made me nervous because the word the word dead was in there. I don't want to hear about dying. And so I hated to go to a doctor because doctors could tell you bad news. I'd rather not know. I don't know if anybody was like that. It was so bad I couldn't visit people in the hospital. Because as I started in, I'm going, there's people dying in here. You could catch it. And I don't want to even think about that. So there was somebody from our home group was in the hospital who I really wanted to visit, but there's no way I could pull it off. There was just no way. And so my sponsor said, well, what if I go with you? And I went, I might be able to do that. If he's right here. So he was right there, and I was a little nervous, but I was able to do it because he was right there. And we're walking down the hall, and I walk in, visit the person, and walk back out, and a week later, I wanted to visit him again. My sponsor said, I'll be glad to go with you. Went there, and there was no problem. And I said to him, I guess someday I'll be able to do this on my own. And he said, no, I'll always go with you. Now you go, well, gee whiz, what kind of a message is that? He was trying to tell me that we like help, but we want to get rid of it as soon as we can so that we can be back on our own. And we do that in AA. And we get God to help us out of that big emergency we're in. And then we thank him, and we're very grateful. But I've got it, God. I'm back. And he was showing me one of our great lessons, that you want to be receiving help for the rest of your life. And when you first come in, you're desperate and you reach out and grab all the help you can get. And if you work the program properly, by the time you pass on, you will be embracing thousands of times that amount of help. And you will be doing nothing on your own. That, to me, is what spirituality is. And that's what step 6 and 7 are for, is to let us to let go of another part of our kingdom and turn it over to better management so that our load in life is lightened and we, in turn, can just enjoy this world that God put here for us to watch and enjoy the show. And so I don't know how I got started on that. Oh, I know. I had no topic assigned to me. And clearly the management didn't think I was capable of covering one of the steps, so I wasn't assigned. So I wasn't assigned any steps to talk about. So I said, hey, it's Saturday night. Let's lighten things up and talk about death. So, I mean, what better topic for a Saturday night? And I'm just drawing on my own experience because, as it turns out, one of the greatest weapons that the ego has, that it uses against us, is your own death. Don't forget, you might die. Oh, yeah, you're right. Now you're all scared and And then, you know, if you're just relaxed and everything's calm, don't forget, you will die someday. And then, oh, yeah, that's right. Oh, God, that's going to be awful. And So I really believe this. That if you just keep looking at your own death until it doesn't bother you anymore, you're free for life to really enjoy your life. Just get that boogeyman out of the closet and get it over with. So we got to change our attitude about it. Now, clearly, St. Francis thought it was a good deal. Boy, he just led up to that great line in his prayers, by dying that we awaken to life eternal. Well, I didn't like that idea when I read that. That's okay for some old guy, but I don't want to hear about that. And so clearly I didn't understand what we're talking about when we say the word. So let me just put it this way. The biggest cause of death is birth. That's by far. There's no other thing that comes close to being the biggest cause of death. So they obviously go together. It's a package. It's supposed to be that way. And so there's 6.7 billion people on the planet. They're all going to be gone. All of them. Every single one. No matter where they are. They're all going to be gone in 80, 90 years or so. Gone. Gone. But there'll be 9 billion others that are here. And so what is St. Francis talking about? Why would be interested in this dying thing? Why should I care about his prayer? Well, our speakers this week so far have all made the point that the person who comes here will drink again. And I think we understand that. So what happens to that person that he doesn't drink again? That person dies. That person literally is no longer that person. And when a person dies, it means his ideas die, or her ideas die. The ideas that we brought here. Old ideas availed us nothing. And as we get rid of them, they die. And on the great line in our big book, I don't know how I got started on death, but I'm stuck with it, so... I bet you're dying for this to be over. Jeez. Where's this guy going? Bill writes that the idea that somehow, somewhere, we'll be able to drink like other people has to be smashed. Sounds like a death to me. The idea, gone, gone. So as these ideas die, the truth is revealed. And that's what the light is. And that's what St. Francis is talking about. That as if we could get all of those ideas to die, if we could relinquish our death grip on them, pardon the pun, there would be nothing left but the truth. It's there. And our true nature is there. And so it's really through this dying process that we can, and Bill uses that word in the big book, we're reborn. We're back to the person that we were when we arrived here. Just a spiritual baby looking around going, wow, this is great. This is amazing. And as time went on, and I remembered, I was talking during the workshop about when my ego started, when I started playing the game on myself that our speakers have all talked about so well. And I was about, it was before we moved to Woodbridge, so I was probably about six. And I was coming home from somewhere in West Haven, Connecticut, and went by kind of a swampy area. And I looked in there, and there was a log in there that if you really stretched your imagination, looked somewhat like an alligator. And I said, oh, my God, there's an alligator in this pond. And I said, well, there's no alligators in Connecticut. Yes, there is now. There's an alligator in that pond. Now, I knew there wasn't an alligator, but it was really fun to be scared of an alligator. You know what I mean? Like, man, this is a little more dangerous going home today than it was. Freaking alligator. He could be following me. It's getting dark, and that alligator. And so I had this little thing going on between me and me. There's an alligator, and I'm going to pretend I'm afraid of it. And the game got better because that night I heard him in the closet. And he was in there. Wasn't a game anymore. I had to call my father. I said, I think there's an alligator in the closet. I can hear him in there. And he had to assure me that there was no alligator. And I finally went, okay, there's no alligator. Well, the part of me that played the part of dreaming up the alligator thought I enjoyed it. I said, well, I'm going to get him again tomorrow. See all those people in the back row in your class? Yeah, they hate you. Really? He never thought I'd buy it. He thought it was, I liked being, had jokes played on me. And I went, oh, I feel terrible that they like, don't like me. And then we started the game. And it just goes on and on. One part of me makes up a story, and the other part falls for it. And it just goes on and on and on until we have two people, as I said in the workshop, at war with each other. And we can't be at peace because now I'm angry at this ego. Now he's some sort of a real enemy. He was just a part of me that thought he'd play a joke on me. And now it's war. It's real war. And I'm just the victim, and I'm caught in all this. And we all get good at that. Matter of fact, the world we end up living in is the charade world. It's the one that this guy keeps telling us is out there. Hey, see that boss over there? He's going to fire you. You see that over there? Oh, yeah. And there's no boss over there that's thinking of firing me. There's no, it's just, but once I think it, I feel it. And once you feel it, it's true. You remember that? You got to trust your feeling. even though they're lying, you have to trust them. So, as time went on, I'm going to be off this topic shortly. As time went on, I got sober and I started trying to work spirituality and started reading other books and getting different ways of looking at this, I realized that this wasn't my enemy. That this was not some evil thing the ego was trying to get me. And I started looking at it like, well, maybe I could make friends with it. You know what I mean? Would just be like that. And so I came up with a name for him. I have a name for my own ego. I don't know if you want to hear it, but I'll tell you what my ego's name is. My ego's name is Frank Morgan. That's who my ego is. Now, there's some people who know trivia, and they know that that is the actor that played the Wizard of Oz. And if you remember, the Wizard of Oz was causing all this trouble about, there's a witch, I'm going to get you, Dorothy, and all that. And it turned out that it was a little businessman that got misplaced somehow, and he was behind the screen with a microphone, just, and it scared the hell out of the whole kingdom. And Dorothy went back there and pulled the thing aside, and he was back there, I guess the game is over. And he was thrilled he could now go home. He was tired of that. So I'm trying to relieve my ego and let him relax and go on home. Thank him for upsetting me for 70 years. And he could sit there and laugh at the sucker that fell for all the charades that went on during my life. And maybe we can make peace with each other. And it turns out both of us love God. And that's my little story. It's important to have stories. It's very important. Some of our speakers talked about that. You can't put spiritual experiences directly into words. You have to talk about them. Jerry did such a beautiful job with the fish tank. And the dog and the hog. I mean, my God. When he finished, you said, I see the third step. I see the second step. You know, you just saw the essence of this sentence that we call a step. And so stories are really very important. So much so that when a speaker gets up to give a talk, he says, I'm telling my story, my AA story. In the back of our big book, we have stories. Stories by storytellers who are sharing their story. You read the story, you connect with the story, with the person. Maybe it's a woman's story and you're a woman and you read it and you go, ah, I'm connected to AA now. And so stories are just very, very important. But stories are stories. You know, it's a story. I heard a speaker one time say, my story is divided into two parts, what happened during the years that I drank, and what I thought happened during the years that I drank. And we all laugh. Yeah, that's right. Yeah, that's right. But maybe the rest of your story is just like that. I've talked about this a little bit. Maybe your childhood goes like this. My childhood is divided into two parts. What happened when I was a child and what I thought happened when I was a child. Which is the official version? What I thought happened when I was a child. High school, two parts. What happened when I was in high school and what I thought happened when I was in high school. And where do we live? We live in the story. And we react to the story. Where'd the story come from? Our friend. Our friend. He's the one who tells the story. So in order to have, in other words, a childhood is just a childhood. There's a childhood. Here's the child, got born, there he is, they're not feeding him very well, and they're doing this, they're doing that. And then the child announces the verdict on the childhood. Crappy. Crappy. Until the verdict is passed, it's just a childhood. And so we get to put the spin on everything, and then we live with the spin. Whatever we decided it was, is the official version. And it's awful hard to talk us out of it. All of our speakers are talking about that. Why is it hard to talk us out of it? It's our story. I put this one together. I know it's stupid, makes no sense, but I wrote it. And I don't let go of things easily. And we go, yeah, it's obvious. And to show you how strong it is, how when we see it, it's the official version. You know what I mean? It is. This is it. And it's really hard to take that back. And there were three umpires, and they were arguing over who's the best umpire. And the first umpire said, well, I call him as I see him. And the second umpire said, I call them as they are. And the third umpire said, until I call them, they aren't. And so you could see each one went one up on the other one over who had the official version. Now, the official version is God's version. And all we got all have to do to see it is to get rid of ours. That's it. Get rid of it. And that's what our steps are. So my story, the way I tell it, has changed over the years. Boy, in my first 10 years in AA, I gave the Catholic Church total blame for my alcoholism, right behind my parents. Oh, that church. Oh, those nuns. And how they scared me. Oh, it was awful. My sister, who now has 32 years in AA, was sitting right next to me. She fell in love with the place. She just loved it. She loved the Latin, the incense. She loved confession. How could you love confession? Confession is where they're gathering evidence on you for later use. They're tape recording it all, and on Judgment Day, boom, there you are. You incriminated yourself. You're going, boom, down, down. That wasn't actually in the catechism, but it was in my mind, and that's the only thing that matters up here. So I'm terrified. She loves it. Same place. Same place. And as time has gone on, I've been able to look at this differently, with a new pair of glasses, as Chuck would call it. And so there was a speaker who went around. He came to Tampa for a while, and it caught on. Art McCormick used to repeat this all the time. And this adage was, abandon all hope of improving your past. which on one level sounds true. But my past has improved considerably since I've been in AA. And I've been able to do, as Bob Darrell was pointing out, I was able to see myself in my parents and see myself in my teachers and see that they were part of everything, and they were doing the best they could. And you kind of end up loving them for how hard they tried with the terrible adversity that they had. And so at first it's begrudgingly, well, maybe it wasn't that bad. That's the beginning. And then later on you go, geez, it was actually pretty good. It was actually, wow, I can see it differently. That's the power of spirituality, is seeing it differently. When I sponsor people and they have problems and they want to come over and talk about them, I know that my primary job is to convince them they don't have a problem. And we sit there and we start talking about it, and they'll go blah, 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 blah. And it all goes back to, I'm going to take this off, it's hot. It all goes back to the first time I had a big problem. I brought it over to my, thanks, Chris, to my sponsor. The sky was falling one more time, and I'm Bill, I got to come over. And I came over there, and I had about 6 months in, and I'm going, I know I'm going to get thrown out of the Marine Corps. They're starting to look at my records, and then I think my wife hates me, and I don't have any money, and I feel sick, and I'm coughing, and I'm like, I'm just a typical newcomer, right? And he said, well, yeah, that's right. Yeah, I can see that. But sit down a minute. Wait a minute. Now, look, you've got 6 months sobriety, man. You're making the coffee now in the meeting. And a lot of people know you. They really enjoy some of the things you're saying. And I was talking to your wife. She's starting to get a lot more comfortable around here. And I see you at work. You're really looking better. You're sharper. I think. And he would just go on and on. And then I would say, well, if you look at it that way, maybe it isn't so bad. So you see what he did? He made me look at it that way and took away the way I was looking at it. And when he did that, the problem was, as Bob quoted out of the book today, removed. It wasn't solved. We didn't discuss it. It was gone. So why was it gone? How does a problem go away? Well, what is a problem? A problem is something that bothers you. If you can learn to not have it bother you, it's no longer a problem. If somebody yakking next door to where you work so you can't think bothers you, you can't get your work done because they're over there, then that's a problem when they go, but if you worked with your sponsor in the program to let it go, and when they did that, it no longer bothered you, that's no longer a problem, is it? Even though they're still going, blah, 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 and it's bothering the person on the other side, but they don't have a spiritual program, so they are going to go over and try and shut her up. which is the normal way in problem solving, is to get the world to change and adjust to us instead of getting the power to adjust to the world. My sponsor was quite a guy. Bob Zanz was talking about that, having the same sponsor for a lot of years. And I had mine for 42 years, 2 months and 2 weeks. And he was known by all my kids, because he came to my house and introduced us to AA, and then when I got sober, they saw him as the reason their father was sober. So there was this wonderful rapport, and we really had quite a life together, even though we were apart a lot of the time. And right near the end of his life, I went back up to Virginia, and the Manassas group was having a big meeting, and they arranged for me to talk there, which was the first meeting I ever went to, and he was in the audience, and we talked about the old days, and I got a photograph of he and I, probably within 3 weeks of him passing away, and that's one of my precious photographs. I wish I'd taken more photographs. That's funny. I'm just kind of reminiscing on things. I was talking at dinner about how valuable the tapers are. Because a lot of AA doesn't do a good job of keeping track of their history. I remember when I had about 10 years, I said, you know what I ought to do? I ought to take a tape recorder and a camera and go around to the old timers and interview them and take a picture of them and just type out whatever they said and then have a little book about old timers in Northern Virginia and go around and take pictures of where the meetings were, because there weren't that many meetings. There was we had 10 meetings a day in Washington, D.C., Northern Virginia, and Southern Maryland. So it wouldn't have taken too long to take a picture of all. And, of course, some of those churches are gone. The office building, maybe, where there was a meeting is gone, gone, gone. So there's no record. Now, intergroups are getting better at doing this, and I know of certain parts of the country. But tapers are preserving it as it's happening. And you can go back and get a tape of the first person to go to California and hear about how California got started and how it got started in Texas and how it got started somewhere else. So I just salute Lee and the other people who get in their van and drive 900 miles to go to a conference and set up this whole operation and bring these photographs and bring a piece of history to all of you that are coming in here. And then if somebody mentions, well, the most important person was like Chuck Chamberlain or something like that, bam, you can listen to him yourself and experience something that took place in the 40s and 50s and 60s personally. So I just am so grateful for the tapers that do this. People ask me, well, why do you keep doing this? Why do you keep doing this? I'm going to tell you why I do it. I don't know about the rest of these people. I do it because it's so much fun. That's why I do it. That's why I sponsor people, because it's so much fun to watch them light up. That's why I go to meetings, because they're so much fun. Fun. Well, it sounds like I'm irresponsible. You're just having fun all the time? Well, it says that the joy of living is a theme of our whole program. I would say if you're not having fun, you're doing it wrong. That's what I would say. If you're not having fun, you're doing it wrong. You can have fun while things are going bad. You can have an underlying happiness that is temporarily being obscured a little bit by some difficult health problem or somebody, your girlfriend left you. All these things that happen in life, you can still have this wonderful sense of well-being underneath, because you know fundamentally all is well. All is well. I'm connected to God. That's all that matters. These things come and go. And I'm fine. Now, as we tell ourselves that's how we feel emotionally. Fine. It's when we decide that this shouldn't have happened. This shouldn't have happened to me. And then, you know, that part of us goes, that's right, it shouldn't. And when you get the little committee going, well, how horrible thing was it that this happened to me? I'll tell you where it is. This is possibly the worst thing ever happened to anyone in history. I might write down a documentation of what happened to me and the circumstance. I was already sick when she left me. She took all the stuff. I mean, this is up in the... Oh, my God, this is... And when you get through, you've got a sort of a Broadway play that you could actually maybe submit so that people could see a real tragedy, because other people never have things that big happen to them. So anyway, I grew up in Connecticut. Went to the Catholic Church, had one sister. My parents worked very hard coming out of the Depression. I learned how to scare myself early on. I don't know if you all learned later or earlier, but I'm thinking 6 or 7. And I did that real good, kept it up, and was very loyal to being frightened by my own thoughts. So I could never have peace of mind. No matter what was going on, it was like this thing would go, well, this is, I know you're ahead by 10 runs, but they're going to get 12 in the last inning, so don't be enjoying the game at all. And I ended up at Yale, and I was trying to be a good student. I was trying to do that, but I was so not at peace with myself that I decided I would join in the drinking crowd. And as soon as I drank, I had peace of mind. And once I got that, I just assumed that I was supposed to use alcohol as the way of living, that I had been given the gift of life. That's what it felt like. Took a long time. Other people started earlier. But finally, at age 19, I was given the gift of life, alcohol. And the gift was that it showed me what the world really looked like. It showed me who I really was. It allowed me to be who I really was. And I just was thrilled with this. So I decided to make it the most important part of my life, just like we try to make God the most important part of our life here. And for a little while, it was wonderful. Then I started getting in fights, going to jail, flunking courses, couldn't qualify for athletic teams. All my dreams are being shattered, and this is just in the first year of drinking. And I just said, well, if that's the price that you have to pay for something this wonderful, I'm willing to pay it. And I made a decision early on, which alcoholics do, that this is so invaluable in our lives, it's worth anything. I had no idea what anything meant. I had no idea what would be taken away by this. But each time it was taken away, I developed a new level of acceptance. Okay, you don't have that. Okay. And you just keep thinking, and I ended up somehow making the Marine Corps and becoming a fighter pilot and having six kids. And it looked like I might be succeeding on some level, but the inside was being destroyed. And I eventually ended up in a nut ward. Withdrawal was awful. And I was terrified in there. But after a while, it was safe. There's something that after a while, a nut ward gets very comfortable. There's no pressure. You just have to make a clay object once in a while. And go to group therapy. And, oh, yes, oh, doctor, yes, you're right. And all of that. Speaking of clay, I haven't done this in a long time, but I've been looking for somebody from that nut ward. There was a Navy lieutenant commander in there, and we were in the same clay class. Some of you have heard this. And we were making ashtrays. And then they would judge him at the end of the week. And everyone in the class agreed that I had made the best ashtray. It wasn't even close. And I had it on that thing over your bed, the table thing that slides there, and I had it there. And he came in, allegedly, to visit with me, smoking a cigarette, chit-chatting, puts his cigarette out in my ashtray and accidentally smashes it on the floor, and he wins first place. And I figure that somebody who did that would probably end up an alcoholic. And if he ended up an alcoholic, he could have ended up in AA. And if he's approaching his ninth step, he'd probably be looking for this poor guy so that he could make an amend. Now, I've forgotten about the incident myself. But I, if you're here tonight, I'll be right up front at the end of the meeting. You can go to the head of the line. Wow. The ashtray story came out of the closet, Chris. Huh? Oh, yes. Oh. Anyways, talking about the serenity in the nut ward, which, and it really was, as time went on, you've been there 3 or 4 months, they even had a golf course there around Navy Bethesda. It had 9 holes, it's gone now. And once you got a different wristband, where you could be seen in other parts of the hospital without an alarm going off, you could wander around, go to the library, and we checked out special service clubs, and we'd be out there playing golf and realizing all our buddies who were hard at work back in the Marine Corps, and we're playing golf and going up and having food brought on a tray, and all we had to do was put up with the psychiatrist a couple of times a week. And it started to get very comfortable because there was no more challenges or anything. I remember when it's time to get out, I remember getting real nervous about leaving the nut board. But while I was there, some AA members came in and brought AA into my life. Even though I drank again right after I was released, I called AA. And my sponsor came and took me to my first meeting in Manassas. And I always like to acknowledge a woman that was there, because I had been sober about 4 hours when I went to the meeting. The meeting lasted 5 or 6 hours with a group anniversary and a square dance and a whole bunch of stuff. And I was trying to leave the place. It was December 7th, 1964, and it was kind of cold, wintry, halfway frozen rain type of night. And I was on the front porch of this dumpy Oddfellows Hall trying to make a break for it, and there was no place to break. There was no street lights. Like, where do you run to get away? Because I didn't know how long this was going to go on, and I had been sober 10 hours now, and I desperately needed a drink. And this Al-Anon lady named Betsy Lynch saw me and came out and put her hand on my shoulder, and said, I turned around, and she looked like an angel, and she had her hand there. She said, come on back in, it's going to be fine. And I believed her. I'll never forget that. I just went back in, and I've been here ever since. Now, I also had the help of a very mean sponsor who didn't put up with anything. He was a man of very few words. One of his favorite words was no. He said that a lot. Bill, what do you think about no? What are you, a mind reader? I didn't even finish the sentence. So anyway, I'm condensing my story so that I can talk about the transformation. Because that's, without that, what do you got? You're still the same old person. You haven't died yet. You haven't died yet. We really ought to say that about, you know, I'm dying to go to AA. I had no idea about spirituality. I was not interested in God. I said all these things. And my sponsor, after about 6 months, he saw my reluctance to try this. And he said, well, listen. Would you do me this? Would you be totally honest with me about your present state? I said, okay, I'll be totally honest. So I just want to do a quick spiritual inventory. How much do you pray? Some of you have heard this. How much do you pray? I said, I don't. I learned something as a kid. I don't believe they work. They're not connected to anything. Even in the Lord's Prayer, I just go, no, 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 no. And I don't even say that at the meetings. I don't like the idea of prayer. He said, so that would be zero? I said, yeah, zero. He said, okay, zero. Do you go to church? Do you like churches? They're very supportive, and maybe you go to church. No, I don't like churches. I don't like go near them. I don't tour cathedrals in foreign countries. I go to museums and things like that, but churches, all right, no churches, no church, nothing there. What about spiritual literature? We got some wonderful New Age, and you could go in bookstores. It's waves of. No, I like mafia stories. I like sports stories. I like Hitler stories. I like all that stuff. All right, zero spiritual reading. What about meditation? This is one of the great practices to give peace. I said, are you kidding? I'm going to sit down and do nothing? Just sit there? I got trouble. I got six kids. I got a little. I'm not going to sit. That's just silly. No. So he went, okay, no meditation, no prayer, no. So 4 zeros, right? I said, yes. One more question. How's it going? How's it going? What does it feel like to be inside of you? Oh, it's awful in here. It's terrible. I'm afraid of everybody. I hate everybody. I can't stand myself. Bam, I'm going to commit suicide. I hate it. I hate it. I hate it. All right, so we know 0000, and that's the result you get. That's just an experiment. It's a very practical thing. 0000, you get this. We want you to try our plan, and you write down the new results. If there are any. Don't believe it. You don't have to buy into anything. All I want you to do is to write down the new results. Would you be willing to do that? And I felt there was a trick involved. And I remember this great reluctance to try it. Like, and you know what the reluctance was? What if it worked? I'd look like a jerk. I've been bad-mouthing this prayer and God and all this stuff for all my life. What if it actually worked? I'd look like a fool. I don't think I'll try it. That was the feeling that I had, and I didn't know they had it right in our literature. We're like a scientist who refuses to perform a certain experiment lest it prove his pet theory wrong. I'm not going to try prayer. What if it works? Boy, my buddies will kid me forever. But where are you going to go? So, I'm involved in the new experiment. Stupid Steps 101. Everything you need is in these steps. Everything you need is in this step. You ever get all that crap from your sponsor? This is it. Oh, you're blah, blah, blah. I'm going, yeah. So I go home, I have the steps, I'm going, I can't find it. Where is the money step? I need the money step, I need some money. There's no money, I don't see money anywhere in here. You're not going to get money, you're going to make amends. What good is that? Make amends? So you could see that by reading the steps, you gain nothing. You just know how to recite words. Doesn't help you. How could that help you to know that you've got to admit you're an alcoholic and you're going to take an inventory? How could that help you? It can't. It only helps when you do it. It's the experience. Spirituality can only be experienced. It can't be known. There's no knowledge. You can't learn anything about anything. You can simply experience it. And when you experience making amends, you experience it, and you feel the freedom, and you feel, oh, my God, I'm so glad I was ordered to go do that. Now, try and describe this to the next person. Well, when you make an amend, you really feel like it's wonderful, and the person who doesn't believe in any of this is going, what? And they will never understand it until they do it. So you can see it's not anything that can be explained. It can only be experienced. So you have to be experiencing our program. That's what is so powerful, is the experience. And ultimately, that experience turns into our promises, which describe a spiritual awakening as well as anything that I've ever seen. Those verbs that are in those promises. I mean, fear of people and economic insecurity will leave us? What is leave us? Like I'm here and they go, hey, where'd it go? You know what I mean? Self-seeking will slip away. Go on. boom. Watch this. Do you see what I'm saying? They're magic verbs. They're not, a psychiatrist would never, don't worry, it'll slip away. Next. Slip away? How could you send a bill for something that slipped away? You couldn't do that. So you read those promises, read those verbs, and you'll see they're magic verbs. They're being done by God. That's why all that stuff is happening. And then after it all happens, you go, whoa. Like, you know how you do that when you go, oh. You've been stupid up till that point, and you go, oh. I think I smell God's fingerprints on this stuff. And we suddenly realize, that's experience. You just experienced God. You suddenly realize, He's doing all this. And I couldn't do it. And now we've had our first contact. That's the definition of an awakening right there. Those promises just capture it all. You have just moved from theory to experience. And boy, when you get that, you no longer doubt anything. You just, wow, this is real. It's real. And then begins the struggle that all of us were talking about. Is having had that experience, why don't we magnify it 1,000 times? Why don't we just incorporate it into every aspect of our lives? And it was read, I think Bob read it, it's the riddle of our existence. Why we don't take this and allow it to happen in all areas of our life. One of the problems with spirituality, and this has also been pointed out in the workshops, is that it works. When you take these steps, your life gets better. It guarantees it gets better. Sometimes quickly, sometimes slowly. How about this magic word? But they will always, woo, materialize. Woo. Do you feel it? Woo. Wasn't here, now it is. They will always materialize if we work for them. So they materialize, and everything gets better. And we feel this overwhelming sense of gratitude. And our friend the ego comes in to join in the gratitude. Isn't this great what God did? Look at that. You got this all back. It's all back. You're not that person anymore. You're a new person. This is it. We ought to thank God for this. And the ego makes up a prayer. Watch out for prayers that come from the ego. Because he's a professional. He said, let's get on our knees. Are you sure? Yes, let's get on our knees. Okay. God, we're here to thank you for what you have done for us. You've taken a wreck of this person. You've restored his health. You've restored his family. You've restored his mind. Restored his standing in the community. You've restored his serenity. You've restored. God, we're so grateful. We're so grateful that you have placed us in a position where we no longer need your sorry ass. That's what the ego feels about all this. Because if we keep going towards God, there's going to be no ego left. So the struggle now begins over who's going to win. Who is going to win? Are we going to become self-sufficient and be proud of our accomplishments? Or are we going to rely on God and always give him the credit? There's any diplomas on our wall, they ought to have God's name on them. And there's the challenge for everyone in this room. And I can't remember who said it. I think it may have been Mildred, that Dr. Young, in that letter, he was commenting on mankind in general, and he was using the devil instead of character defects. And he was saying that humankind struggles, and they always lose. How do you like that? They always lose. Unless they have a spiritual experience and are in a society that helps them maintain the spiritual experience. Sounds like AA to me. And it sounds like events like this, home groups like yours, is where we gather as a group to make sure we don't lose this thing. And where do we lose it to the ego. And we just don't want that to happen. We want other people to help us see ourselves. Am I screwing up? Am I screwing up? I go and talk to people. I'm thinking this, am I screwing up? And then they tell me. I don't want to figure it out myself. I want feedback. So if you're new, get in the habit. Get feedback. Does this sound solid? Does this sound spiritual? I don't know. I'm giving you my best shot. This is what I think. And when you do that, you're getting a new pair of glasses. You're getting a perspective with many years. You're getting a perspective that enables you to see the closer and closer to the truth. And as you see it, you feel it. You just go, what a great world. I mean, it could be raining and pouring. I just love it. What a day. And you go, what's wrong with that person? They're connected to their higher power. So if you're new, I wish you the best. To the two that got the big book, and I talked about this in New Haven, that book is about you. It's all about you. And when you finish reading it, you'll finally know you, because you don't know you yet. You know the false you. You know the story about you. You know the crap that you made up about you. But that book is going to show you who you really are. And when you see yourself, you're going to cry with gratitude to see how beautiful you are, how loving you are, and how you were made to carry this on to the next person. And good luck with your job. Thank you.